This is Radio EcoShock. We go now to a new talk by author David Corton. His books, When Corporations Rule the World and The Great Turning from Empire to Earth Community, have set the pace. His latest book is Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. It couldn't come at a better time. This new talk was recorded September 27, 2010, by the presenters, the UBC Reed Sustainability Program.
Now, I'm assuming that you're all here because you are quite familiar with the fact that as a species, we are in deep trouble. Is everybody on board with that? So I don't intend to get into a lot of detail and statistics about how bad our situation is. I assume you already know about that. I'm going to focus on trying to provide some frameworks to take us into a deeper understanding of why we're in that problem and what it means for what we need to do. And I'll warn you that my approach, my take on the situation, is that we have to change virtually everything. That we have to fundamentally reinvent our cultures and our institutions, at least particularly our modern cultures and our institutions, and particularly the institutions of the economy. Now, I know this is part of a series, and you're going to have another speaker who I gather is working on the premise that we can fix all these problems with some clever technologies. I take strong exception to that view. I mean, it's a nice idea if we could do it with technological fixes, but to me, if you really understand the nature of why things are going so badly wrong, it takes you into a recognition of how badly our institutional and cultural frameworks are serving us. Now, all of this can be terribly depressing, unless you put it in this context, that we humans are creation's experiment in reflective consciousness. We are part of a much deeper evolutionary process by which life has evolved toward ever greater complexity and consciousness. We are a species with a reflective consciousness that gives us a capacity to choose our future with conscious collective intent. You're of a generation that's grown up with the information technologies that allow us to come together as a species and to make decisions as a collective whole in a way that has never been possible before. And what advantage of drawing in a few older folks like myself, having lived through that transition, we can see much more clearly the implications of what a profound shift this is that you folks, most of you folks, grew up with and take for granted. Now, to understand where I'm coming from, I think it is necessary to understand a bit of my background. I grew up a little south of here, down in the United States, in the state of Washington, a town called Longview. Just go straight south about, I don't know, from here maybe 300 miles or so. A very white community, very non-culturally diverse. You know, I grew up in a monoculture. The most exotic people that I knew was my aunt, who was a Catholic. And there was a rumor that my grandmother voted Democratic occasionally. Anyhow, I assumed that's where I would spend my life. I went off to college to prepare to come back and run the family business. And, you know, one of the very few ways that my formal education affected me was I happened to take a course in my senior year outside of my major field on modern revolution, and I learned about these communist revolutions that were a threat to our American way of life, and that was one of these fundamental changes in life. I decided instead of going back to my hometown, I would spend my life working overseas and in regions of Asia, Africa, Latin America, bringing to them the secrets of American business and economic success so they could become happy consumers like us and forget all this revolution nonsense. That was quite a dramatic shift, and of course that threw me into a totally different life in which I was deeply immersed for 30 years of working in international development, living 21 years outside of my own country, immersed in the diversity of cultures of Africa, Latin America, and Asia. on this mission to modernize and bring prosperity to the world. Now, I'm kind of a slow learner. It took me something like 30 years to figure out that what we were trying to do was not only not working, but it was having disastrous consequences for most people. That, you know, a few people, of course, were getting very rich, but most people were getting deeper and deeper into desperation. We could see the deterioration in the environment, in the forests, and the fisheries, and the rivers, and the lakes. And I spent 15 years in Asia, which is a region that I particularly love because of the deep, rich culture and the traditions of strong family and community. You saw those cultures being torn apart, families broken up, communities broken up. I began to turn, well, actually another piece is you need to know this. In the earlier stages of this, you know, I went to business school, got an MBA and PhD from the Stanford Business School, taught for a time at the Harvard Business School. So I'm coming all at this all from a business school background, and very much an establishment background. And one of the things that I valued about my business school education was that we learned to think about organizational systems. Now, of course, in business school, and you know, this is a subject I taught at the Harvard Business School, but of course what we're teaching is teaching the students how to organize a corporation. You know, organize the culture and the incentive systems, authority systems, information feedback, all the different aspects of the organization in order to shape the behavior of those people that worked in the organization to keep focused on the bottom line and maximize the corporation's profits. Now, I was kind of in the field that Charles was in, and many of us had this idea that, well, you can make people more productive if you can get them really working together effectively in teams. And that's really good for the people, and it's also good for the company because they can generate more profits as a result of that. That's a whole different story. But the key point here is that since I talk a lot about the economy, a lot of people think of me as an economist, refer to me as an economist. It's actually not technically accurate. My field is organizational systems. And it's very key to understanding how I think about economic relationships, because I'm not looking at pricing systems and so forth. I'm looking at institutions and culture and how those shape the behavior, not just of people in corporations, but in terms of shaping the behavior of whole societies. So it is a deeply systemic perspective. And out of my international work, I came to the point of, okay, let's figure out, you know, as I began to realize what was happening in terms of the devastation in the world, I came to realize the same things I was seeing in Asia and other places I work, the so-called underdeveloped countries, that those same things were playing out in those countries that we considered to be the models of development. Canada, United States, Europe, Japan, that they were all moving toward more and more people in desperation, increasing poverty, cultural breakdown, environmental destruction. So you begin to realize, wow, this is truly systemic. And you start looking at what does this tell us about how we are organizing as a species, how we're organizing as modern societies. And what can we do about it? And it was out of that inquiry that led to writing When Corporations Rule the World. That was the first cut at laying out my analysis of what's really going on with this global system, and particularly the organization around these powerful institutions of global corporations that are designed to maximize financial profits at all costs. And I want to say a little bit more about money. You know, this is really interesting. This is part of, you know, part of what I came to, realizing that absolutely foundational to understanding this whole system is money. Is money. You know, back in 1992, I got together with a number of non-governmental organizational leaders in Asia. I had just moved from the Philippines back to the United States, but I went back to the Philippines for this little gathering, very small gathering. We spent 10 days together reflecting on the Asian development experience. And what does it tell us about what these civil society organizations and non-governmental organizations needed to do? And we started talking about the experience of development moving out and destroying communities and villages, colonizing the land, converting it into taking over the resources that people depended on for their livelihoods, and turning it into corporate property, and then essentially turning the people that used to live off of those resources into serfs working for corporations. You know, a recreation of serfdom, of colonialism, of a pattern that I eventually realized has dominated human affairs for 5,000 years, but that's another big story. But in terms of this meeting in the Philippines in Baguio, mountain resort, we began to get this image, this money. It's like money moving out across the countryside, absorbing and destroying life every place it touches. If any of you have ever seen it, this is a really old movie, but the old horror movie, The Blob, that was the image that came to mind, this undifferentiated ball of protoplasm. Whatever life it touches, it just absorbs into itself. And I thought, that's really curious. How could that be? What is this thing called money? What gives it this power? Isn't it just a number? How could it have a motive drive? How could it be inherently life destructive and evil? That's my definition of evil, that which is destructive of life. And I struggled with this for days with the group, and we talked about this, and eventually we realized money, of course, has no motive energy. The only energy is our human energy, our life energy, that has become deflected and distorted and misdirected by our obsession with money. I've come to think of it almost as a cultural trance, and it is so extraordinary as you think about it, because it is nothing but a number created with an accounting entry. You know, I wrote the book When Corporations Rule the World, but the truth is, you ready for this? The accountants run the world. The accountants run the world. I saw someplace that some of the highest paid business graduates in their first jobs are those that go into accounting with the Wall Street firms. And as you think about it, it makes perfect sense, because all those games going on Wall Street, they call, financial innovation, is nothing but creative accounting. Most of it fraudulent, misrepresentative, but that's where the money is in playing these accounting games. So it makes a lot of sense that accountants would be in great demand on Wall Street. Anyhow, you come back and you begin to think about money. Where does it come from? Who decides who gets it? And you think about, we have moved over a very long period of time from societies that once had no money, no equivalent of money. It's also interesting, if you study biology and living systems, there is no equivalent of money in a natural system. But we've gone from societies where relationships were based purely on caring relationships, or non-caring relationships, one or the other, but they were not mediated by money, to a situation where in modern societies, particularly right now, virtually everything we do as an individual depends on money. And more of our relationships are mediated by money, to the exclusion, in many instances, of caring. And yet we never step back and ask the question, wow, doesn't that give incredible power to those people who are in a position to create money and decide who gets it? Control that power, and you control society. Now, I'd be willing to bet that this is an idea that none of you have heard in any of your classes in the university. I certainly didn't learn about this in the university, which in itself is really interesting. You know, where money moves determines the fate of nations, determines who eats and who doesn't, who has a place of shelter, who has no place to go. You have enough money, you have access to everything. You have no money, you have access to virtually nothing in our modern society. And yet nowhere do we discuss it in these terms. This tells us something about the state of our society, and including the state of our intellectual systems, the state of economics as a discipline, and the state of our universities. But this is part of the much larger conversation that we have to come to a deeper understanding of what's happening to our world. You know, very simple terms. All familiar with the financial crash back the end of 2008, which I gather didn't hit quite as hard here in Canada as it did in the United States. I understand you also have felt the effects of it. Now you step back and you realize what that was really about. Was we structured our money system. Back when I was growing up, most of our financial institutions in the United States were community-based. There were community banks that had no branches. It's one single office of a bank, owned by people in the community, takes deposits from the community, makes loans to businesses in the community like my family's business. The banker knows the people he's giving the money to, knows their reputation, knows their history, knows that the community depends on those businesses, and you know, they work things out. Community banks, mutual savings and loans, which are really cooperatives, credit unions, which are also cooperatives, which means they're organized as non-profit cooperatives. Could you imagine a money system based primarily on institutions that are not private for-profit, but are actually managed by and for the community? Now we have people in the United States on the screen, that's socialism. I don't know, I think of socialism as when the government controls everything. This is about community control. To me, cooperatives are not a socialist institution. Cooperatives are actually, to me, the ultimate manifestation of a market economy. You know, part of a market is private ownership. Well, a cooperative means everybody owns something, has an ownership share. That's a pretty good idea, as long as it's done equitably and rooted in community. Now, what happened through deregulation? You know, I mean, a piece of this financial system, of course, is I assume most of you realize that most of our money is created by banks when they issue a loan. And that capacity resided in the community, and it meant that you had institutions in a community that if you had opportunities in your community to connect unutilized resources with unmet needs, to invest in real productive capacity in your community, responsive to things that the community wanted and needed, you essentially created your own credit with those financial institutions to finance those activities. Now, over time through deregulation, we saw consolidation of those banks, mergers and acquisitions. Many of the community institutions were taken over and operated as private, publicly traded corporations. As the system shifted, it moved from providing real financial services to the community to concentrating the control, the power to create and allocate money in the institutions of Wall Street. Totally removed from the community. Totally unconcerned with productive activity, with the social or environmental consequences of how the money was used or the businesses were run. But concentrated in institutions that were able to create money from nothing to pump up financial bubbles, to engage in speculation, to create loan pyramids where banks loan back and forth to each other, create fictitious assets which become collateral for more lending and so forth, so that you get more and more what I call phantom wealth accumulating in these hands of these institutions that are totally undemocratic, totally unaccountable to any human interest other than, quite frankly, not even the interest of their shareholders who might be, you know, pensioners and so forth, and pension funds that own some of these funds. but predominantly to their own managers who are managing these institutions to maximize their own bonuses. That's part of the perversion of what's happened. It's recognizing that money, you know, this is another part of our illusion of the trance that we're in. We are conditioned to believe that money is wealth. And if you believe that money is wealth, it's very easy to believe that people who are creating money are creating wealth. Now, when this process is simply going on within these Wall Street institutions, there is no real wealth creation. It is simply a process of creating more and more of these accounting chits, which gives their holders more and more claim on the real resources of the rest of the society, to say nothing of more and more control over our politicians who write the rules and then are directed to write the rules that further facilitate this process of fraud and corruption. So you begin to get a picture of why these institutional issues of institutional design, how we really structure our economic institutions, how we structure our money system, is extraordinarily significant to all the problems we see in society. Because if you understand the dynamics of this money system and how it plays out through global corporations and our other economic institutions, you understand why our financial system is inherently unstable, moves inevitably through cycles of boom and bust, currently is propped up solely by public subsidies. Why that system creates an imperative for the larger economy, as we measure by GDP, to continuously expand. Why that system inexorably drives ever faster environmental destruction. Why every day more and more wealth concentrates in the hands of fewer and fewer people. Why our institutions are losing legitimacy. The social fabric is disintegrating and our political system is becoming ever more corrupt. Okay, so that's a pretty discouraging picture, and I realize I'm kind of probably leaving my notes. You know, I get a little deeper into some of these things. So at this point, you're probably thinking, gee, so what's the answer? The answer starts with a conversation. It starts with a conversation to change the framing stories of our culture by which we understand the purpose of the economy, our human nature, the possibilities to design our economic institutions in a different way, by which we understand what we really value, understand our human nature. Are we truly just greedy individualistic? Or were we in fact, did we evolve to live in community? You know, and the answer to that is pretty simple. I mean, you think about it. Are most of the people you know evil, violent, greedy, individualistic, or do you have some friends that are really pretty decent folks who really care about the world, who you can count on? Yeah. That's nice, isn't it? And you know, that's the way most people are. That really is our human nature. And you know, the truth is, yeah, there are some really evil, angry, individualistic, greedy, untrustworthy, violent people in our world. You step back and you realize these are the psychologically disturbed. These are the people who are in deep trouble. These are people who need help. These are people who should perhaps be in some sort of mental institution rather than running our political organizations and our corporations. Maybe went a little further than I should. But that's part of waking up to the reality. It's part of changing the story. So this is so fascinating to me. The first step toward deep change is a new story. Talk to your friends about money, about the money system, about money as a system of power. Talk to them about these questions of what is our true human nature? What is our possibility as a species to rediscover our true humanity rediscover what it means to be a healthy human being, rediscover the fact that we evolved to live in community and, in fact, cannot survive outside of community, and that from all the things we know from our studies of public health, the stronger our communities, the more equitable our societies, the healthier people are physically and mentally, the happier they are, the more democratic our societies, the more creative people are. This is a possibility. This is what we can be. Second, we create a new reality from the bottom up. Charles asked how many people are eating food out of their garden. You know, when I grew up, my grandparents had gardens and we raised chickens and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And then we kind of moved away from that, most of us. But now people are beginning to go back to that. One of the groups that I'm deeply involved in is the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. You have a network of Business Alliance for Local Living Economies here in Vancouver. This is an organization that's working with communities throughout Canada and the United States, rebuilding our local economies based on local businesses, rebuilding our local food systems, our local building systems, our local financial systems, our local information systems, which is all about restoring our control over our economy and at the same time doing it in a way that is rebuilding the relationships of community. That's all about creating this new reality from the bottom up. The third critical element in the change strategy is change the rules. Ultimately, we've got to get back control of our politics. So we write the rules in ways that favor real democracy, real community control, more moving back toward more local self-reliant economies that are engaged in real investment, creating real wealth. In contrast to the rules that we have now that generally favor the ever greater concentration of economic power in financial institutions that are simply engaged in creating phantom wealth to increase their control over the resources of the rest of the society. Now this change is happening, the awakening is happening, it is all happening at a blinding rate. Another of my activities is Yes Magazine. I don't know, how many of you are familiar with Yes Magazine? We published down on Bainbridge Island, Puget Sound. You know, we're about yesmagazine.org. Take a note of that, because if you're ever feeling a little hopeless and a little glum, go to our website or subscribe to the magazine, and it's just filled with the stories of the people who are creating this new reality and doing it on an increasingly significant scale. This is not marginal activity anymore. This is the creation of the new mainstream, but you don't read about it in the conventional media. There is hope. To me, it is extraordinarily exciting. We, as I briefly mentioned, we've been organizing around dominator hierarchies for some 5,000 years. If you look at the earliest societies, they were built around community. They were built around connection to the earth. They were built around a deep spirituality. And many of those who study this earlier period believe that they were based generally on gender equality, that they were largely nonviolent. But then some 5,000 years ago, we moved into an era of empire, and we started to create these dominator systems, and we started to divide ourselves into dominator pyramids with a few people on top, most people on the bottom, which then puts us all into a position of competition for the privileged positions, and it makes a huge difference whether you're on the top or the bottom. And then that plays out in sexism and racism, classism, all the other isms. But we're now beginning to develop the communications capability to communicate directly with one another, to break through these illusions, to share the truth with one another, and to begin to organize from the bottom to create this new reality, to take back our lives, and to carry forward what I think of as the great democratic experiment of moving to a position of true popular sovereignty.
Radio EcoShock.
You have been listening to David Corton, author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, recorded at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada, on September 27, 2010. The UBC REITS Sustainability Program is bringing in some great speakers to stimulate students and staff. They also recorded Stuart Brand in a speech on October 5th. Find links to all that as free MP3 audio in my EcoShock blog entry for this show. Just click blog at ecoshock.org. My thanks to Justin and the whole crew at UBC for sharing these fine speakers.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.